Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All right. Welcome, everyone, to this week's Value Investing Live. I'm pleased to welcome our guest, Stephen Keel, founder and chief investment officer of Arquitos Capital Management. Now, for all of you out in the audience, we do welcome you back. We did take a break last week. We transitioned back into the office. Fortunately, we were having some internet connectivity issues, so I'm operating from home once again, but we shouldn't have any issues with our live stream today. As always, for those of you out there, please let us know in that chat section where you are coming from. We love to see all of those international viewers out there. Today, Stephen will have direct access to those chat questions as well, so please feel free to address him directly. He will see those as he comes in, and we'll be answering them directly. So if you have questions about the presentation as things are coming up, toss them in there. We'll get to them as we go along with things. Without anything further from me, do please turn your attention to Stephen, and I'll hand things over now so we can go ahead and jump into that presentation.
Well, great. Thank you very much, Graham. As you mentioned, my name is Stephen Keel. I'm the CIO, founder of Arquitos Capital. We'll get into kind of the background a little bit with Arquitos and also the other firm that I'm associated with, which is Willow Oak Asset Management. And I wanted to do things a little bit differently today, I think, than maybe some of the other presentations. Always happy to talk about stocks, and I think we can get into some of that in the Q&A. But I'd really like to kind of address things for kind of new, emerging, aspiring managers as well, as they're launching a firm or a few years in or looking to grow kind of looking at different opportunities and challenges and things like that. And I think part of my history and my involvement and perspective with Willow Oak, which handles operations for emerging managers, hopefully will be valuable here. I'd like to share that. And, as Graham said, if there's any questions that pop up, either now, if it's live, please go ahead and put them in the chat. And if they, are appropriate to the slide that I'm on, I'll address that. And if it's something a little bit different, maybe a question about stock or something like that, we'll have plenty of time at the end to do that. And any recording, people who view this later as a recording, shoot me a note on Twitter. Information is here on the screen, Stephen_Keel. Send an email to invest@arquitos.com, and happy to kind of interact, and always looking for good stock ideas as well, as we all are. And there's some really great interactions, I think, especially we have on Twitter. So that being said, start up here. This, a little bit of background on Arquitos. This is the investment philosophy that I carry out. And it's probably not very unusual, compared to some of these other presentations that have been made. This is the guru focus, general value oriented, fundamental, bottom up approach. I had a very great, very nice interaction a few years ago presented at Guru Focus Live in Berkshire, and really enjoyed that. Met a lot of great people. I think we all kind of share the similar approach, but we apply it in a slightly different way, right? And it doesn't mean we all have the same holdings. Clearly, everybody has different perspective and how they have different challenges or opportunities given their own history and experiences and how they apply that to the investing world. And that's really my biggest piece of advice, that you have to apply your strategy and philosophy in a way that fits with your personality. So it's not wrong or right, for example, to be concentrated or not concentrated. There's a lot of great investors who have had very, had very kind of diversified portfolios. Thinking of Irving Kahn, think about Schloss, think of even Ben Graham, if you take away his big position, which is, you know, kind of outside the realm of how he typically invested, but take away the Geico position he had. He was very diversified. And, you know, some people are more quantitative in nature. Some people are more qualitative. So for me, I like to take concentrated positions, sometimes highly concentrated positions. We generally have about 12 positions, and the top five generally make about 75% of the portfolio. Now, when you run a fund, there's a big difference too, compared to what you might be comfortable holding as an individual investor. I have a friend, Thomas Brazil, who typically does distressed investing. He runs a firm that focuses on distressed investing, but he also invests in equities in his personal portfolio. And he just put up a tweet the other day that said 95% of his portfolio is in the GOED warrants, you know, and that's how he feels right now. And he's comfortable doing that. You know, he has other kind of sources of income and things like that too. And he understands the risk and the reward profile there. But you can be more concentrated in your personal life. And also when you're younger, I think too. Now the risk is you have to understand what you're doing. So if you don't understand what you're doing, and you have to be very humble and self-aware about that, then you should probably be more diversified. But as you progress in your, whether it's personal investing career or whether you're you run a fund as well, if you know what you're doing and you can more accurately analyze the risk reward situation, then it might be appropriate to be more concentrated if your personality matches that. For me, I like to go very deep into companies. I like to do deep research. I like to follow companies for years, sometimes before. I mean, sometimes I'll follow, have a watch list company for 4, 5, 6, 7 years before buying into it, or longer. You know, I've been investing for 20 years now, and there are companies that I've followed all along that I just haven't had the opportunity to invest in. But I might still. So, you know, there's still things we read the 10Ks and we go through the filings and things of that nature. So anyway, I like to be concentrated. You know, in terms of industry analysis and things of that nature as well, I have a bit of a eclectic background, a non-traditional background. I did not come up in the, you know, on Wall Street or as an analyst and buy side and things like that. I have a law degree, not an MBA. And so what I've kind of self-taught in many ways. And so, you know, what I came up on the analysis side is if I can understand an industry, if I can understand the company, and if I can have an understanding of the variables involved with that company or industry, then I'll be comfortable investing in it. And if I don't feel comfortable in that, if it's, you know, again, being intellectually honest about your circle of competence, then it's, there's things that I avoid. And some industries just attract a type of manager or capital allocator that is outside of my kind of comfort zone of who I'd like to partner with, you know? So it, some people might be more comfortable who are investing in the oil and gas or commodities or things like that. For me, there's so many variables involved there that are kind of outside the control of the manager or the company themselves, the decision maker, that, you know, I am very, very humble to some of those industries, and I don't necessarily want to ride along with some of those decision makers who have risk profiles that are significantly more aggressive than mine. And so I'm industry agnostic, but there are probably a couple of industries that I avoid. And, you know, again, last thing here, you can read the screen, but I think the alignment of interest is very, very important. And especially if you run a fund, because if you have outside investors, they have to match your duration, your time duration. They have to match your, you know, when you're riding along kind of side with you, the manager should be significantly invested in their own portfolio. The investors that they have to respect and be humble to, you know, they're giving their money to an outside manager to manage. And then, you know, same thing along the lines of the companies that you invest in or I invest in. I want there to be high insider ownership. I want there to be, you know, directors. I want them to own stock. I want senior management to appreciate the long-term value of the stock. I want there to be some buybacks occasionally if the price gets attractive for the company. But you know, again, that has to be tempered with proper capital allocation and decision making. You know, options and things like that, and restricted shares. It's okay, but oftentimes it's they're kind of done in a way that are not conducive to long-term kind of thinking for the company. You want to, you know, these options that kind of are handed out by some of these companies, to be very careful to realize that those are actually an expense, right, to the company itself. And a lot of the tech companies over the last 15, 20 years that have come public, you know, there's a way to kind of fool those who analyze the company, those who take a more superficial analysis, that you know, these things are actually expenses that you need to adjust for. But to have that alignment with ownership from people who work there is a positive thing. So a little bit about me. And like I said, I have a little bit of a unique background, non-traditional, and to touch on a couple of these things here. I was a collegiate athlete. I ran track and cross country in college and things like that. I think it's important, and I want to kind of address this to both current aspiring managers. I think it's important to have that competitive background. You know, not everything is just sitting here going through 10. I mean, I love to sit back and read, you know, and talk to management and interact in that way. But like what I love doing day to day is sitting back and reading the filings and reading about the company and trying to just determine things on my own, and gathering information as necessary to do that. But you have to have that competitive nature. Otherwise, you're not going to make decisions to really do very, very well. Because, you know, you have to decide when to go all in on a company or when to make it a large position, and things like that. And, you know, I have some friends who are great at analysis, great at quantitative and qualitative analysis, but, you know, they're too afraid to, when they find a great investment, they're too afraid to kind of make it a 20% position or something like that. And again, it has to match their personality, but at the same time, if you find the investment of a lifetime, you got to go all in, right? This is kind of the Druckenmiller thing in Soros that we can learn from those investors. And, you know, I think having that competitive background, whether it's, you know, athletically or whether it's something from chess or something, you know, whatever it is, intellectual competition, that's really valuable to have. And if you're looking to invest in managers, or if you're an aspiring manager yourself, you really have to look at yourself and say, well, you know, am I willing to do I have that? Not necessarily compared to other people, but compared to your kind of previous self and compared to the, you know, maybe the S&P 500 or whatever you're comparing yourself to in that way, you know, cause it doesn't make sense to put in all this work if you're not going to be able to beat the market, right? Probably by a decent chunk. Cause you know, otherwise throw your money in the S&P 500 and run with it. And you know, you get a 30, 40, 50 year timeline, let it grow. Then I joined the Army out of college, just retired actually 21 years as a reservist, and had a deployment and a couple other full-time things through the years. I originally came up as an enlisted member when I was deployed back in 2005. It was combat support. And then later I got my law degree and was a lawyer for Army Reserves for about 13, 14 years or so. You know, and that background was very helpful on... I didn't know this at the time. I didn't think about this at the time, but it became very helpful when I started managing money, especially other people's money. It gives you a great perspective on risk management, right? So, you know, when I was in Iraq, we have plans to do things. Plans never work out as they're written up. And that's the case as well with investing. You have to have these contingencies. You have to be able to adjust as the circumstances adjust. You know, we, as an investor, you can kind of ballpark, so to speak, the inputs, but you can't always control the outputs. And you have to understand that there are a number of different variables, things that happen that are way outside of the control, unexpected. And, you know, you have to adjust for that. I mean, who would have seen COVID coming, right, a year and a half ago? And you have to have a wide perspective of either companies you follow, industries you follow, being willing to change your mind, you know, at various times to do that. And I got that perspective really enhanced from my Army experience that you have to kind of face reality as, you know, on reality's terms as to what it's been presented to you. And you have to have contingency plans. And if the circumstances change, you have to change too. So you have to be humble in that way as an investor. And after that, I was in, after college, I first worked in public policy for a number of years in Washington, D.C., which, you know, again, a great perspective on the power of the government, the power of regulation, the power of the Fed, power of the Treasury. And, you know, these are variables that you have to take into consideration as an investor. We see a little bit about this with, you know, inflation. Is it going to be transitory or not? You know, whatever you feel about kind of what the Fed and Treasury has been doing the past number of years, going back, you know, since the housing crisis. I think it really pays to be humble to the power of the government. Tax rates make a big difference. Different stimulus programs and things like that both create risks and opportunities for you as an investor, both with industries and specific companies. I was a lawyer for a number of years as well before I started the firm. So, you know, what I would recommend, again, for talking more for aspiring managers here, is you want to get as broad of a perspective as possible. You know, whether that's in your career like I did, or whether it's in kind of your hobbies or different interests, it really pays to be a little bit more renaissance-y, I'd say, than just kind of coming up, you know, going to college, getting an MBA, going to work on Wall Street or whatever. That's fine, and you'll learn what you need to learn. But I think to build, you know, a firm where you're looking to do this as a lifestyle for 50 years, you know, something that you're never going to, it's not a job, right? For those of us who've kind of had these different experiences, you know, it pays to get as broad of a perspective as possible. And the other positive thing from that is you meet a lot of great people along the way. And part of that network is it helps with your success. It helps with idea sourcing. It helps with meeting people that you can rely on to get kind of accurate advice back. People who I've met during these different experiences have, you know, been real estate, legal, private equity, you know, Wall Street, et cetera, et cetera. They've lived in different countries. They've worked at different, you know, management positions. And I've relied on those people to do due diligence. You know, if I'm learning about a new industry that I didn't have experience with, and I'm looking for kind of on the ground perspective, I've reached out to those people who I've met along the way. And it's been very valuable. I think those horizontal relationships, you know, like that, where you're actually getting feedback that is as kind of peer-to-peer feedback, as opposed to kind of analyst to PM feedback, I think that's really helpful. And so I have a number of people in my network who run funds who have kind of eclectic backgrounds as well. And it's very helpful to interact with them. And I think my experience is helpful to them as well. So we can chat about those types of things. And my pathway to launching the fund is here. So I began kind of personally investing in 2002, did some friends and family money, then went on to managed accounts, launched the fund firm in 2009. I was still doing work as a lawyer and started doing managed accounts and launched the fund. So, you know, I want to kind of pause there before getting into the enterprise diversified and things like that. So managed accounts are an inexpensive way to get started. So if you don't come from the industry or if you don't come from family money and you want to get going, you can launch a firm fairly cheaply. You can use RIA in a box or use other service providers that for a couple thousand dollars, you can get everything up and going, get compliance, and get all the regulatory and legal stuff going, and you can start managing money. And you can do that while you're still working. And so, you know, if you're looking to get started and you don't have access to, you know, a great deal of money, you don't have access to, or you don't have knowledge, you know, if maybe you're not in Wall Street or don't have that history from the industry, I've seen a lot of people get started that way. And there's a lot of things you can do to gain credibility. You know, first of all, building that track record with the managed accounts is a great way to build credibility where over time you can grow or launch a fund or something like that. A lot of people have really tremendous blogs or write-ups, or they write for Guru Focus, or they write for Seeking Alpha, or they write, put something on SumZero or Value Investing Club or something like that. And that's a great way to get credibility, to flesh out your ideas, to get feedback, and also to begin to meet, you know, a network and meet other people, not only peers and other aspiring investors, but also potential people who will invest with you later on. I began kind of networking in 2007 or 8, and a lot of the people I met back then were very close, and they did not have funds at the time. I didn't have a fund at the time. And then we ended up launching them. And, you know, and if you look back to like Buffett, Munger, Rick Guerin, and all these guys, you know, I mean, they had those same types of networks. You know, think about Buffett and Munger and their interactions. Munger was a lawyer. Munger was not managing money at the time that Buffett and them got together, and Buffett encouraged him to do that. And so, you know, I think it's really valuable to have that presence on Twitter, online, and, you know, write up some things, gain credibility in that way, and advance, you know, get better as an investor and accept that feedback. And you can do that before you even start the managed accounts. You can start managed accounts, and then, you know, if you want, you can launch a fund after that, or you can continue to grow the managed accounts. I stopped working externally when I launched the fund in 2012. And, you know, then from there, we took over a small public company, Enterprise Diversified, in late 2014. And then a couple of years later, launched Willow Oak Asset Management, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Enterprise Diversified. And it handles operations, outsource operations for kind of affiliated firms. We'll get into that a little bit as well. And then in 2008, I launched an offshore fund for Archidos Capital. And that's kind of the pathway, you know, as you kind of go along the way. I had a lot of people do this. Some of the funds that were the firms that we're affiliated with Willow Oak have done it this way. A lot of people in my network and, you know, managers now that run more than $1 billion have kind of started this way. And, you know, you have to remember people, you know, think about it like a David Einhorn or a Loeb or Daniel Loeb and things like that. These guys started, yeah, they were more in the industry at the time, but they started with a small amount of money. So don't let that, or lack of connections or lack of resources, kind of financial resources. Personally, you know, I grew up relatively poor. I didn't have family money. I had to kind of do this on my own. And, you know, don't let that hold you back. If you really are talented and you really are, you know, want this to be something you do for a long, long time, the rest of your life, which is possible, there's resources out there, and you can start with a very small amount of money and you can grow it. You know, compounding, we all know here, you know, all the Guru Focus followers, we all know the power of compounding, right? Even if you don't really raise much money in the beginning, or if you never raise money, people will find you along the way. You know, you can put some information out there, you can write up some stuff. If you're good, people are going to find you. And, you know, if you don't worry too much about that also, and just worry about compounding it along the way, you know, the numbers become very large if you have that long-term perspective. So, you know, if you're starting or you're trying to position yourself to raise money, this is just a good way to live these five aces. So Peter Kaufman is on the board of Daily Journal with Charlie Munger. They're very close. He runs a company called Glen Eyre out in California, and he invests with a number of different managers. And he created this list a number of years ago as to what he looks for in a manager: total integrity, deep fluency in what they're doing, a fee structure that's fair, uncrowded investment space, and a long runway. And he's not saying that you need to have every one of those, though you certainly should have the first couple. but he is saying that, you know, these are what managers and investors, portfolio managers, and people who run firms should look to have. And if I think he has another comment to say, well, if you have every one of them, and you're looking, if you're an investor and you find someone who has every one of them, give them as much money as you can, because that hits everything that's necessary here, including the long runway. And when you say reasonably young in age, you know, we have some people who were affiliated with at Willow Oak that are in their 50s, but they're going to be doing this for another 30 years still, 20, 25, 30 years, because, you know, they've arranged their life in a way that you know, they can do that. They've taken away kind of the operational burden. They've set that aside, so that's not stressful for them, and they get to do what they love. So they can do this for their entire life, and other investors can kind of ride along with that. So we don't, doesn't mean to, you know, you need to be 22 years old or something like that, but you have to have that long runway. If someone's in their 50s, they could still continue to manage this for 20 or 30 years. And I think, you know, these five things are a great thing to aspire to. And, you know, be honest with yourself. You know, do you actually have an uncrowded investment space that you're invested in? You know, sometimes you're not. It doesn't mean it's large cap, small cap, you know, US-based, international, whatever the case may be. You know, you can be a large cap investor and have a unique perspective on that, and that's okay. But, you know, it's kind of the whole thing where, you know, don't just be the market. You know, it's going to be hard to really outperform the market significantly if you are the market. One other thing I'd like to mention here too, the fee structure. You know, we all have this perspective on the old Buffett style, 0 and 25 over 6, over 6% hurdle. And it's a different world. You know, if I could push back on that a little bit, as fair as that was back in 1960 something, right? It's a different world. What were interest rates back then? You know, what was the risk-free rate? And also we're talking about Buffett, okay? And just because he did it, doesn't mean you can do it. You know, he knew he did not need to raise the fund. He was already personally very wealthy. He could have just managed his own money along the way and done obviously exceptionally well. None of us are Warren Buffett, right? And so the regulatory environment is much, much, much different now. You're going to have expenses in the fund that he did not have back then. I would highly recommend having even just a 1% fee or something like that, and then the management fee, or sorry, the performance fee. And even the hurdle, you know, again, he had a 6% hurdle. You know, what was the 10-year back then, right? What was the 10-year in 1965? What is it right now, right? 2%, lower than 2%, one point whatever percent it is today. And it's a totally different world. That's a very significant difference. I personally have I have a 1% management fee. I have a 20% performance fee over a 4% hurdle. And, you know, if I was going to recommend someone starting up today, I'd say have that 1% management fee. It's, you gotta take care of yourself. You gotta pay expenses. Things are so volatile today. There could be years where you make no money, and you have to be able to feel secure and comfortable enough to focus on the portfolio and not have to go get another job or be worried about your, you know, you're not going to perform well in the portfolio if you're worried about how to you know, pay your expenses, or you don't have the resources to go travel to meet with companies in non-COVID times or to do things like that. You know, you need to have the resources to do well. And so you have to have some kind of money coming in the management fee side. And the other side of it is, if you don't have a management fee and you have a couple down years, you don't want to be incentivized to quit. You know, you want this to be a long-term 30, 40, 50 year thing. You have to have the resources to last through those down periods, and everyone's going to be down for a couple of years in there. You know, I've had the fund, we've done very, very well. Launched 2012. We've done gross 23, 24% a year. And, you know, I had those down 3 years in a row. People like Manish down 3 years, you know, and it's going to happen. There are times where your investment strategy is just out of, you know, it's not matching what the market's giving you. And we have to be humble to that. And, you know, you have to, you're not trying to get rich during those time periods. The management fee is not going to do that for you, but you have to be able to pay your bills. And you don't want to be taking, you know, if you have your own money invested, you don't want to have to be taking too much of it out. Cause you're going to start making decisions then that are not in the best interest of everyone in the fund. Okay. Considerations for emerging aspiring managers. So a few things here. We often forget that we run, you know, you're running a business. You're not just running a fund. And so I want to kind of put your focus on the business side here. And are you doing this as a craft, right? Or are you doing it as a business? And either one is perfectly fine, but you should decide, you know, because if you're running it as a business, you're going to make some decisions, and it might affect the way you do on the portfolio side. It's how you might affect how you present yourself to investors. Or do you want to, you know, do you want to run it as a craft, where you're kind of solely focused on the mechanics of, you know, the portfolio side as well? You might not need the investor relations people. You might, you know, have different minimum investments and things like that. And so, you know, decide how you want to run the business. I mean, if you're running as a business, you might do run like an a special purpose fund or something like that, SPV, where, you know, you're taking a big position in one fund because you're trying to attract some new investors and things of that nature, but you might not do that as a craft, who knows. But I think decide that. And then as things come up, you know, you can address how you make those decisions. Are you going to partner with someone in the beginning, both on the investing or the operation side? You know, I had a friend in the beginning of when I launched the fund that I considered partnering with on the investing side. We would split the portfolio 50-50. And I'm glad that didn't happen. I, you know, it's a friend and someone who I respect a great deal. But I realized a couple of years in that our strategies were different enough that we would have kind of clashed. And some people can do that as a partnership. And, you know, so don't kind of dismiss it out of hand, but you have to really consider, is this someone who I can partner with for, again, a very, very long time period? Are we aligned, you know, in our strategies and how we make decisions? You know, I found personally that, again, I like to make concentrated positions, and, you know, it's very difficult to do if you have someone kind of looking over your shoulder. If you have a partner that's saying, oh, I don't know, you know, about this, is sometimes, you know, this is kind of the dirty secret. Not everything is quantitative and qualitative. You know, you have kind of subconsciously, as you get more and more and more experience, you see, get this pattern recognition. And sometimes it's a subconscious thing. You get a feeling. And, you know, and you can't always explain it fully. I mean, you want to be careful about the risk management on things like that. But sometimes you follow your gut, and that does happen. And it's not a bad thing to do, because as you get a lot of experience, you start to get this pattern recognition that sometimes is difficult to verbalize. And if you have a partnership, or you have, you know, certain investors that are kind of always chirping over your shoulder or something like that, it's going to be difficult to make the decisions that you think are best for the long-term success of the portfolio. Operationally, you know, what are you going to do in the beginning? Whether it's managed accounts, you can kind of handle some things in the beginning. And as things grow, though, and as you start a fund, you have to think about compliance, investor relations, who's going to answer the phone calls, who's going to try to raise money, you know, who's going to have those meetings, who's going to keep track of all the record keeping. There's a lot of work on the operations side, and all the regulatory filings and stuff like that. You can outsource some of it. You can outsource all of it. You can hire someone to do it, but then do you want to be comfortable, you know, being a manager to the person you hired, you know, because then all of a sudden you have additional responsibilities there. And then the other thing is, you know, are you interested in seeking or accepting kind of seed capital or acceleration capital? Do you want to own 100% of the firm yourself and compound it over time, raise money and compound it, and 30, 40 years from now, it's all you? Or are you in a little bit more of a hurry? Do you think there's people who would be interested in partnering with you? And I would say, you know, on the seed and acceleration side, you have to be very careful that they are aligned with you philosophically, time duration, and everything like that. I've seen both good and bad. You know, I've got a good friend who took his firm from about 15 million to about 600 million now because of a great acceleration capital that they received a couple of years in. And they ended up working out of that person's office. That person was very, very helpful to them, not just with raising money for the fund, but also on the investment side. And then I've seen, you know, total opposite side, where somebody got seeded 50-50 position early on, a couple million dollars. That was their opportunity to get started. And there was just never alignment there. And it's held them back over the years. And it's actually caused their performance to not be as great as it otherwise could have been. Because that seed capital, you know, kind of forced him to size positions differently, or close out positions, or other things like that. So just have to make sure that you have that alignment. Okay, so Enterprise Diversified, we took over a small public company in 2014. It was a lot of work, has been a lot of work since then. Not something I would necessarily recommend doing. It is an SEC filing company, trades on OTCQB exchange, SYTE. And it's been a certainly a huge challenge for the years, but it also has been rewarding, and it has given a great perspective on the inner workings of a company. What we did is we launched Willow Oak Asset Management a few years in. We seeded a fund, Alluvial Capital, Dave Waters, and then we partnered with a few other funds, which we'll see on the the next screen, I believe, where we handle the operations for them in exchange for a fee share. So these are the funds that we're affiliated with. Willow Oak Candles, I have Arquitos there. Willow Oak Candles, the operations for Arquitos. We have Alluvial Fund, Bonhoeffer Fund, Keith Smith, Focus Compounding with Jeff Gannon and Andrew Kuhn, who many of you probably know, and SVN Capital as well, Sri Viswanathan. So, you know, what we do at Willow Oak, and I'm the executive chairman of the parent company, but we've got a great team, and each team is kind of five people involved at Willow Oak, and they handle all aspects of operations for these funds and in exchange for primarily a fee share. And, you know, you think about who's answering the phone when a new investor calls, who is keeping track of all the records, who's interacting with the auditor, who's interacting with the administrator day to day, who's setting up and approving like things like wire transfers. You know, these things takes time, and who's dealing with compliance. And so who's doing the bookkeeping, you know, for the management company. So the Willow Oak team, these five people spend a portion of their time on each of these funds, and each of those five people have different skill sets that are applied here. And there's two things to that. You know, one, it frees you up as a portfolio manager, but also, you know, to focus on the portfolio itself, but also it shows that infrastructure, and it provides scalability on the infrastructure side, both for raising money. Because if you're raising institutional capital, they want to know that you have the operational setup that can grow and succeed, and has a wide range of knowledge and experience. And so Willow Oak provides that. And I think over time, for the portfolio manager, certainly has done this for me, the portfolio managers, it frees up the stress of the thing that we don't want to work on. You know, we got into running funds because we're interested in investing. You know, we're interested in analyzing companies. We're interested in talking to people about investing. We're not interested in haggling with the broker about a wire transfer. You know, and sometimes that takes a couple hours dealing, like, you know, we're doing like subscription agreements and, you know, walking an investor through all that. Like, that's not our job. That's not what we're interested in doing. And if you don't have that operational support, you're stuck kind of doing those types of things. And so I would highly, highly recommend considering where you're at right now, whether you're aspiring or whether you're a current fund, how much time that takes, how much, you know, how much more you could actually accomplish too if you did not have those operational burdens, and how much less stress you'd have that allows you over time to get better returns, you know, because when you're focused on the portfolio, you want to be in the right state of mind. And you don't want to kind of in the middle of research, you don't want to have to get phone calls about, you know, kind of matters and more operational matters. The other thing I've seen is, you know, there's some managers out there who have smaller funds, and every once in a while, just kind of out of curiosity, I'll send them a request as a potential investor. And sometimes I get responses back weeks and months later. You know, at Willow Oak, what we do is somebody makes a request from our website or some other thing. They send an email, and our investor relations person is returning that within 24 to 48 hours, and they're setting up a call and they're passing along information. And you know, that's very valuable. If you have prospective investors reaching out to you as a portfolio manager, you're not always going to be available, and you also don't want to be the one having to deal with that as well. You know, updating the pitch book and the tear sheet and all those collateral marketing materials. Let someone else do that. And free up your time so that you can focus on the portfolio and do. And if you're an investor as well, like you want the portfolio manager to focus on the portfolio. You don't want all of their time spent on these matters. So yeah, you know, this is kind of it here. Happy to answer some questions. We've got a couple that popped up here. Let me stop the video, stop the sharing here, and we'll stop sharing. Pop the video back open here. So we got a couple questions here. I need a copy of the record. Graham, I don't know if you have kind of any other ones that popped up here. Thank you. You're referring to my hair. So once I retired from the Army earlier this year, I was able to kind of grow out a beard and grow the hair out. which is funny, but I appreciate the comments about the service. Thank you very much. Graham, do you have kind of any other things that we can kind of address here?
So we'll, looks like we actually did have one just pop in here from Million Dollar Afro here. If you want to go ahead, we'll start off with that, and then we can jump into some back burner questions we have as well while more of those questions flow in.
Great. Philosophy, you know, that's an excellent question. The question is, what is your philosophy for selling a stock? And boy, that's a tough one. You know, I'll give my perspective, and I'm humble to the fact that it might not be the best perspective here, but hopefully it'll be valuable to you. It's very easy. It's much easier to determine when to buy a stock, right? You can do the analysis. You can, you know, you have the valuation. You can kind of ballpark what you think the variables are. You can see what your commitment level is. You can get, basically you're getting comfortable with it to own it, you know, over the long term as necessary. And for selling a stock, though, it's a challenge because, you know, as value investors, we understand that things get mispriced. You know, this is why things get really cheap relative to the intrinsic value of the company. And that's why we're going to buy it, right? And also things can get very expensive, you know, relative to the intrinsic value. And sometimes you want to let that run. And I think some of the best investors, you know, out there have allowed some of their positions to get overvalued. And sometimes they stay overvalued, and sometimes they get even more and more overvalued. So just because it's gotten to what you consider fair value, I don't think you want to sell. I think you want to be very careful, because what happens is companies who do very well operationally and have great people involved with them are much, much, much more likely to surprise on the upside than the downside. And so a lot of these companies that you think, okay, maybe they're fairly valued right now, 2 years from now, you look back and it's obvious that they were undervalued. You know, so I think if you go back, okay, how do you, you know, when you talk about selling positions and things like that, you know, first, if your analysis was wrong, you know, if you thought one thing and then facts kind of bore themselves out, you know, that's a good reason to sell if your thesis has changed or you realize you made a mistake. And that has nothing to do with making money or not making money on it. You know, that you can make a lot of money on a mistake, and you could lose money even when your analysis is correct. So, you know, if you made a mistake, I think that's a reason to get out of it. If for some reason you've lost the commitment level, you know, you have to be disciplined and you have to have the commitment to a company and its stock. And if you lose that, then I think that's a reason to get out as well. You know, if there's something changes at the company, you know, whether operationally or people involved, or if they're, you know, they did something different in the, you know, maybe they divested something or they made an acquisition, or there's something changed the direction of the company that you're not comfortable with, or you're not, is not within kind of your circle of competence, you know, I think that's an opportunity to get out as well. Valuation is just such a tricky one. You know, it's such a tricky one. There are times certainly where things can get so overvalued that, you know, there's an opportunity cost, or you're worried that there's, you know, going to be future downside. It's just really tough, just straight on valuation. You know, so, you know, I would just be careful. Everything is an opportunity cost though. You know, you're looking at all of the things on your watch list or your other positions, and you're trying to kind of size them appropriately based on the risk reward profile. It's just really difficult to get out of a position that you might've had for a long time that has performed very well. And, you know, there's the old saying, when you don't want to pull the flowers and water the weeds. And honestly, value investors, you know, we have a tendency to do that. And I think you just want to be humble and maybe let things run. You know, if you think it's overvalued, give it some time, patience. Don't make decisions based on a month or a quarter, or even a couple quarters, you know, kind of let it run. Let's see here. Got some questions about Enterprise Diversified. You know, these are the kind of, you can go to the Enterprise Diversified kind of website and things like that. I don't want to be kind of talking too much about a particular company or the stock. but we've had a couple of different industries we were involved in through the years. And I think we're most excited. We've kind of exited them for the most part. And we're most excited with the asset management business, and think there's a really exciting kind of future there. And also the, you know, the last couple of years as we've been involved, it's done very well too. So excited about that. see investment advisors. Do you have investment advisors who are not physically located at the home office? Yeah, you know, this is the great thing with the industry. You know, I told you when I ran the managed accounts, I was still working as a lawyer. And, you know, that's not an uncommon thing where people are working their full-time job and then they're starting to manage money on the side, see if they can gain traction. And it's, you know, a low-cost thing. They start to build that track record. And so you don't need to be in any particular area. We have an office here in New York that we launched, or we've had the office for 6-7 years or so. And we've had, you know, sometimes the portfolio managers come into the office, sometimes the support do. During COVID, we haven't really had as much of that, though we get together occasionally. You know, you don't need to kind of be at the office itself. You can, you know, you can work out of your home. And, you know, this person, the question is kind of the Series 65 advisors. You know, it depends what you're doing. Are you managing the portfolio, or are you providing kind of fee planning or other advice like that? If you're providing that kind of fee planning advice, that's a little bit different than what we've done. I don't know that. You know, that's a kind of a different setup. So I can't really comment on that. But you know, if you're managing a portfolio and you're not providing kind of financial planning assistance, I don't, you can certainly start very, very cheaply and you don't necessarily need an external office. How much emphasis do you put on getting in contact with company ownership? So whoever, Million Dollar Afro, there are a lot of great insightful questions. again, I think it depends on the manager, right? It depends on you and your personality. The one word of advice I would give, or caution I would give, is, you know, most of the people who've gotten to senior positions in a public company are great at sales. And if you talk to them, you'll probably be persuaded. You know, you have to kind of be humble about your own biases. You're probably going to like them. You know, they're probably had a great history and experience. They've been kind of salespeople, and that's okay. You want that, you know, in companies that senior management can sell their product, but you have to protect yourself about being kind of unduly influenced by them. And so, I do not always talk or meet with management. I do not always even read their investor presentations. You know, I like to go to original sources first. I don't even read kind of sell side or even the buy side stuff sometimes. I'll just go to the original sources, make up my own mind, and then from there decide, you know, next steps. So there are times I talk to management, there are times I don't. I think it's valuable, if you talk to management, to ask about competitors and ask about other companies in the industry and what they think about that. I think hearing their perspective on that is oftentimes more valuable than hearing what they think about their own company. You know, it's kind of like you go to the realtor is always going to say, now's a great time to buy, you know, a house, even if it's not. And it's not that they're trying to deliberately mislead you. It's that, you know, incentives and things like that. So you just want to be careful about it. Let's see, anything else, you know, to kind of expand on maybe a research process for a minute or two for me. And I think you want to do whatever matches your personality. Over time, you'll figure out the best way that works for you on Scuttlebutt and stuff like that. For me, you know, I started investing as an individual. I didn't have access to a Bloomberg or CapIQ or some of those other resources. And I enjoyed reading 300-page documents, you know, or at least glancing through them. And so I would always go to the original sources. I'd go to the SEC filings. And even today, I have alerts set up through my RSS feed for S1 and S3 filings, for 13Ds, you know, for things like that. My watch list, I'll, you know, kind of go through the Qs and Ks. I'll have Google alerts set up for things like tender offers and rights offerings and things like that, CVRs. And that works for me. I like to go to the original sources first. I like to kind of figure out what I think about the company oftentimes before I even look at the stock price, because I think you can be unduly influenced, you know, by the stock price or by other people's opinions. And then once you get that, then go search to make sure that what you read is accurate. So you can ask the company some kind of questions, like factual questions. You can go look at other, even buy side or sell side research, that to make sure that you're understanding it as correctly, and go from there. Talk to other investors. You know, having a network for idea sourcing and discussions, and that's valuable. But you don't want to be too deferential. You know, you really have to have confidence in your own decision making and your own analysis. And it's kind of a weird dichotomy that you have to have as an investor between ego and humility, right? Because if you're interested in a company that is trading at, you think, a mispriced trading price, you know, you have to have the ego to say, I'm right as to what this company is worth, but everyone else who's involved in the company is wrong. And at the same time, you know, you have to be humble that oftentimes the market is right. Not always, but oftentimes they're right. You know, there's kind of all those psychological sides to it. And when you're talking to other investors or you're talking to management or whatever the case may be, you know, you also have to be skeptical you know, appropriate. You don't want to be deferential in those cases. Okay. Considering those documents are always so dense, what are the most important sections? So this is, I think, where the legal background was very helpful, because you realize you don't have to read every word in these, you know, the 250 page S-1 filing. And even, you know, look, some of these 10Ks for the mega cap companies are massive. They're massive. You don't need to read everything. You know, you want to skim it, look at what looks unusual. You know, what's the purpose of this thing? And, you know, anytime there might be 10 or 12 S1s or S3s, you know, every day, I'll take a quick glance at them just to see if anything stands out. I'm not reading 200 pages of each, you know, the 10 or 12 or whatever. But, you know, you can glance, look at the first couple pages, see what the purpose is, see whether you recognize the people involved or what the purpose of the document was, and, you know, then set it aside if it's interesting. Yeah, a lot of this is finding a needle in a haystack, and you're just trying to kind of have this pattern recognition of situations that might have worked out for you before or just seemed to be interesting. But yeah, when you glance through, there's a lot of repetition, a lot of legalese. I mean, even in the 10K, you know, you're going to have a lot of repetition. I always go directly to the financials first. So go to the, and I always start with the balance sheet. And, you know, my strategy, my philosophy is, you know, I want to be invest in companies that have strong balance sheets, low amount of debt, a lot of opportunity in the future to reinvest, high kind of reinvestment opportunities. And also, if they need to lever up, have the capacity to do that if they find an attractive opportunity. And so this balance sheet has to be strong kind of at the outset. And, you know, and then on the, in the income statement side, you know, I'm looking at kind of predictability, and you want margins to be growing, things like that. You know, this is all, I don't want to get too much into kind of the quantitative analysis. Everyone's going to do that a little bit differently. But, you know, I start with the financials and then see what questions I have from them and go into the footnotes and see if those questions can be answered. The other thing that's valuable, I think, is to, when you're looking at kind of Q's and K's, is to compare. You know, there's different software programs where you can see how things have changed for each filing. You can, you know, compare it kind of PDF language and stuff like that. And that's valuable, you know, if it's a company you own or if it's a company you're looking at seriously, why did they change certain language? You know, it's not just the results, but it might be, why do they have a new risk factor? Or why are they describing something different than they did in the past? So I think that's helpful. Okay. Anything else, Graham? I think this is some good questions there. I appreciate those.
For sure. And I will echo the earlier statement, $1 million afro, some great questions there. Selling actually being one of our favorite questions to ask here, because obviously it's a hard one to answer and everybody's got a different opinion on it.
Absolutely.
One I will put out there that we've had come up recently, I guess, or in decent consistency across these presentations with market valuation kind of getting to where it's at this point in time, things skyrocketing in price. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you've mentioned having some, I guess, good commitment for going in on positions that you feel confident in. Are you seeing new positions or showing up at any point in time? Are you finding yourself sitting on more cash than you usually would? You know, where are you sitting at this point in time with the market?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I have a mix of special situation holdings and then more long-term holdings that I think those long-term holdings, I'm looking for kind of that high ability to reinvest their cash. So you have a high kind of cash flow yield and you have, you know, high and growing margins and you have just high reinvestment kind of ROIC. For the special situations, though, there's typically more of a catalyst. So we've had some positions earlier this year, a company called Namtai Properties MTP, that there's an activist involved. They were going through a court battle, and there was a private placement that was getting reversed from this court battle and a special meeting and things like that. You know, that was much more catalyst oriented, much more special situation oriented. Got a couple things as well, a couple companies that we think there might be a buyouts. They received an offer, but you know, not accepted or things like that. So I think in this environment, you want to use every kind of thing in the toolkit, so to speak. And you know, I'm a big fan of Joel Greenblatt. The book, You Can Be a Stock Market Genius, has so many great strategies for special situation investing. And you know, there's a lot of opportunities right now that are not always kind of even on the long side or more traditional kind of long-term investing that you can do. You know, all these things with some of these meme stocks, if you can be smart about it, there's options opportunities there that you can do both on the upside and the downside, protecting in and leave some things like that or out of the money calls. There are companies that have different kind of spin-offs, might have some corporate restructuring. I mean, there's a lot of exciting stuff happening in the SPAC world, right? Mispricings. I'm not saying buy and hold stuff. I'm saying mispricings that you can do. You can really arbitrage a lot of these things right now. And so I would say, you know, I don't know specifically. It's hard to say, is the market, you know, overvalued or not? I mean, we're in such a unique environment with the way interest rates are and everything that's going on in the economy. There's so little predictability right now. That it's tough to kind of make a top-down assessment of the market as a whole. But look, there are so many great arbitrage opportunities. And if you're worried about the long-term sustainability of the market as a whole, I think there's always, you know, Peter Kundal used to say, there's always something to do. And there's so many great opportunities to arbitrage things where the amount of risk can be so low. And you know, whether it's SPACs, whether it's some M&A stuff, whether it's divestments, you know, there's a lot of fun things going on. I mean, heck, there's you know, I'm not into this as much, but there's crypto stuff that you know, could be a lot of fun, and you can do really, really well and understand your risk with some of these positions. I mean, you could look at the SPACs that have not made a acquisition that are trading below $10. You know, you can make a couple 5-8% guaranteed. Nothing to laugh at.
Definitely.
One question looks like just popped in here. Preferred means to discover the events that Greenblatt discusses. Yeah, great question. I'll tell you what I do every morning. I have RSS feed set up through Feedly, F-E-E-D-L-Y. And I'll do various types of filings. I'll have those pop up in the RSS feed. I have different keyword terms, Google alerts, names, activist investors, types of filings. And then what I do every morning is I pop open the iPad, I pop open Feedly. I've got, you know, blog posts and things like that. All the companies that I own are on my watch list. I also have them pop up in my RSS feed. So if any news happened, the first hour or two every morning, I just go through the RSS feed. I see what catches my eye. I see what happened, you know, yesterday, last night, this morning. And, you know, I think that's a great way to distill a lot of information in a short amount of time. Cause you know, you don't need to read everything that happens there, but if something happened with the company that you otherwise didn't see during the day, it's nice to have that headline pop up. And if you want to read more, you can do that. So I do that for the first hour or two every day. And then whatever catches my eye in that feed, and we're talking, you know, there could be 500 things in that feed, and I'm just kind of scrolling through. Whatever catches my eye, I set aside, and that's what kind of the rest of the day looks like. You know, do I want to get into that particular company? Do I want to look more into something that, you know, is potential opportunity or a risk there? Feedly, F-E-E-D-L-Y. And you can use like a free version. I think I paid, you know, $50 or $30 or something like that for the updated version. But there are other free RSS feeds that you can go through. And the key is you get little excerpts of Google Alerts, SEC filings, other things like that, blog posts, like any updates from blogs or news. And it's an easy way to kind of scroll through and go through a lot of information in a short amount of time. And then, you know, the rest of the day is, again, addressing those things. Or if I'm kind of learning about an industry or I've stuff on the watch list that, you know, I might spend a few days or a few weeks just kind of focused on that one particular company, trying to learn about it.
Absolutely. All righty. Well, it looks like that is going to round out our questions today, right as we are hitting that time mark as well. So perfect timing there. Great. Steven, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming out, taking the time to join us today, answer all these great questions from our audience. We do thank you and appreciate you coming out.
Yeah, thanks, Graham. And for those who'd like to kind of continue the conversation, again, you know, Twitter is a great way to do this. Send me a note if you want more information on Arquitos or Willow Oak. You know, go to send a note to invest@arquitos.com or go to willowoakfunds.com. If you're an investor or aspiring manager or things like that, you're looking to share stock ideas. Again, I think Twitter is such a great resource for that. And you know, always looking for great ideas as well. So feel free to reach out, and I hope we have the opportunity to connect in the future.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.